Hello, my friends. It's Wednesday, June 25th, 2025, and I'm your host, Radical Russ Belleville, your Red State refugee. And welcome to the Radical Russ Show, coming to you from Roller J Studios in my undisclosed mountain hideaway in the beautiful state of Jefferson region of Southern Oregon. On this week's Smoke Session, it's 2003 all over again as we go to war in the Middle East over fake WMDs. Israel kills Gazans waiting in food lines while a fake cop hunts Democrats in Minnesota. A Democratic socialist may be New York's mayor. Democrats get manhandled but still refuse to fight back. The Supreme Court is shitty to immigrants and trans kids, again. Parents charged for child's death and a dead woman gives birth. Boise gets shittier for unhoused people next week, and my analysis of the greatest TV theme songs of all time. But first, before we get to all that serious stuff, just three quick hits here. The reason my podcast is late today is because I'm kind of under the gun. I'm heading to Nampa, Idaho this weekend for my 40th class reunion with Nampa High School. I've been to my 20-year reunion, my 30-year reunion, now headed to my 40-year reunion. And it's always fun going to my class reunions because, you know, Nampa, Idaho's in the conservative county in Idaho, which is kind of like saying the sauna in hell. It's a bit redundant, but Nampa's a very conservative place, and that's how I got the nickname Radical Russ. I was part of a group called the Nampa High School Radicals, and I kind of organized the thing, and we stood up for all sorts of issues in our time, one of which was high school dress codes. But anyway, heading back to the class reunion, when I went back to the 20th class reunion, I had just started in 2005 with Oregon Normal. I was literally like 2 months into my marijuana activism career, and I was so excited. I was telling everybody about it and how we were helping medical marijuana patients and putting on these big meetings with marijuana plants and getting clones to the patients. And boy, you could just see people kind of slowly backing away. Like, I don't want to be in any photographs with the pot guy. Like, they were really nervous and scared about it, right? Then I go to my 30th year class reunion in 2015. I'm a full decade into it. We've already legalized marijuana in Oregon. It's going all across the country as far as medical marijuana. I was working for Normal at the national level. I was getting national news headlines and such. So when I went back for the 30th reunion, it was kind of interesting because some of those same people that were a little nervous about being around the pot guy, 10 years later, it was like, hey, Russ, I have a friend who's got cancer, and do you know of any way that I could, hey, I know somebody that's got multiple sclerosis. Is there any way that just in 10 years, even in Idaho, the view of marijuana being this deadly, criminal, dangerous drug, gateway drug that leads inexorably to heroin, that attitude had already changed even in the state of Idaho in just 10 years to viewing marijuana as a medicinal substance. Now I'm heading back in my 40-year reunion, and I'm retired from my marijuana activism career. It'll be interesting to see what all my friends have to say about it now that Idaho's completely surrounded and Idahoans are regularly driving, at least the folks in the Nampa, Boise, Meridian area I grew up with, are all within a half hour to an hour's drive of 12 legal marijuana shops across the border in Ontario, Oregon. So I get to go back kind of with the I told you so attitude and feeling quite like a winner. As you know, I'm a hobbyist podcaster, and so how I manage to keep the lights on and pay the bills is by doing various gig apps. And so I'm out the other day doing the gig apps, and I pick up this wedding party of young people, had to be in their 20s for sure, about five of them that piled in to the SUV, and I'm driving them around. And I don't know how the subject came up, I forgot about it, but there's a young man sitting in the front seat with me. And, I should make it known, these are all white kids, right? All these white kids in the car. And I don't know how it came up, but somehow NWA's Fuck the Police came up as a subject of discussion. I don't know how, but the white kid right next to me just busts right into the lyrics.
He just goes right ahead and says, "Fuck the police, coming straight from the underground. A young ninja got it, Brad, because I'm brown." Except he didn't say ninja. He actually said the N-word. Like, right there in the car with me and all the other white kids. And like, is that a thing now with Gen Z? Do they just feel like they can just say the N-word? Or is that something they're only doing in all white circles? I don't know. I'm an old guy, but it kind of shocked me. Speaking of marijuana, I got a quick hit for some marijuana news, a marijuana moment. Good friends out there that run that outlet have reported that Texas has expanded the state's medical marijuana program. They're going to allow now new conditions, chronic pain, traumatic brain injury, Crohn's disease, inflammatory bowel diseases, and end-of-life patients in palliative or hospital care can access marijuana. A wider range of cannabis preparations they can use now, patches, lotions, suppositories, approved inhalers, nebulizers, and vaping devices. They're also going to increase the number of medical cannabis business licenses in the state of Texas. The entire state of Texas has 3. They're going to increase that to 15 for the entire state of Texas. Okay, so I just have one little quibble with this, because Marijuana Policy Project has gone out now and said with the passage of this law, Texas is now the 40th medical marijuana state. And folks, I got a quibble with that, because nowhere in Texas's law does it allow a medical marijuana patient to use any marijuana. This is another one of these, what I call non-smoking medical marijuana states, where they can allow you to have like tinctures and lotions and concentrates and preparations and patches and suppositories, everything but an actual joint. And I just got to say that if you are a medical marijuana patient and you cannot smoke a marijuana joint in your state, you are not in a medical marijuana state. You may be in a medical cannabis products state, a medical cannabis pharmaceuticals state, but that ain't no medical marijuana state. The big news this week, of course, was Donald J. Trump needing to soothe his narcissistic injury from the No King's Day protests, making his little tank parade look sad. In order to distract us all, and in order to soothe his bruised ego, he went and unilaterally ordered the bombing of nuclear enrichment sites in the Islamic Republic of Iran. And let me make this point immediately. I am no fan of the Islamic Republic of Iran. I know, taking a step out there really on a limb, Russ. Iran, of course, the biggest state sponsor of terrorism. They're just an awful force. And you know me, I'm against theocracies of all form, Islamic or Christian or Jewish. I'm against all theocracies because you cannot subpoena God. But anyway, Trump dropped these massive ordinances, and you've been following it all week long as I have, declaring victory. We've completely devastated Iran's nuclear capabilities, only for CNN to come back an hour or two later and say, no, it doesn't appear like they've really destroyed everything. Not only did you not destroy everything where you bombed, but also you were bleeding about it for so long on your truth toilet that Iran, they're not stupid. They're like, yeah, it looks like this guy's going to bomb us. Let's move all our shit. So they've still got their nuclear fissile material that's 60% enriched. They still got their centrifuges they need. You may have set them back a few months, which, hey, perfect for Bibi Netanyahu, because, you know, Iran is always just a few months away from getting a nuclear weapon. But here we go again. It's 2003 all over again. We're lying about a Middle Eastern country that starts with an IRA and having their weapons of mass destructions imminently poised to destroy the West. We've heard the story before, but at least this time we get to go through this story without any Rush Limbaugh and no jingoistic Toby Keith songs.
hooray for small favors. But I want to talk about how the Democrats have reacted to this. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was among the few who came right out and said, what Trump did here is completely illegal, is completely unconstitutional. We are not at war with Iran. There is no imminent danger from Iran. There was no briefing of the Democratic leadership in Congress. There was no bringing this before the Congress to have a vote, a complete violation of the War Powers Act. This man must be impeached. That's a direct statement. That's directly understanding what we stand for. That is not what we got out of the congressional leadership on the Democratic side. Let's start with Hakeem Jeffries in the House. I'm going to read you his statement. This is after Trump has bombed Iran illegally. This is what Hakeem Jeffries had to say. Quote, Donald Trump promised to bring peace to the Middle East. He has failed to deliver on that promise. The risk of war has now dramatically increased, and I pray for the safety of our troops in the region who have been put in harm's way. President Trump misled the country about his intentions, failed to seek congressional authorization for the use of military force, and risks American entanglement in a potentially disastrous war in the Middle East. First, the Trump administration bears the heavy burden of explaining to the American people why this military action was taken. Second, Congress must be fully and immediately briefed in a classified setting. Third, Donald Trump shoulders complete and total responsibility for any adverse consequences that flow from his unilateral military action. Wow. I'm sure he's quaking in his boots now, Hakeem. Let's just break down what you've put here in your statement. In your first paragraph, Donald Trump made a promise and didn't deliver. Okay. And you're going to do what about that? And what's the result of that? What's the impact of that? The risk of war has increased, and I pray for the safety of our troops. Oh, okay. Lots of prayers. President Trump misled the country and failed to seek other. Oh, so he's a liar who breaks the rules. Really? Really? Trump's a liar who breaks the rules. What a surprise. And so what are you going to do about it as the leader of the Democrats in one of the co-equal branches of government? Okay, so you're going to say Trump has to explain himself, and Trump has to brief Congress, and Trump shoulders responsibility. Nothing about what you're going to do. Like immediately file articles of impeachment. Like refuse to vote on any more of Trump's bills or nominees. How about that as a start? Another milquetoast reaction comes from Senator Cory Booker. And I'm not going to read the entire Senator Cory Booker statement because it's 12 freaking paragraphs long. And it's a lot of the same Weasley Trump oughta language that we found in Hakeem Jeffries' statement. I'll give you the breakdown of each paragraph. Paragraph one, Iran's bad. Paragraph two, Trump didn't stop Iran. Iran might still get nukes. Trump decided to bomb. Trump should have asked us. Trump ought to answer questions. Iran's bad. Trump's not good at this. Trump didn't ask us. Trump ought to talk to us. MAGAs ought to be bipartisan. I hope our military's okay. That's a summary of the 12 paragraphs from Cory Booker. Absent any indication that what Trump did was illegal, nowhere in 12 paragraphs can Cory Booker come around to say that what he did was illegal and unconstitutional and worthy of immediate impeachment. Here we have Booker in the Senate, Jeffries in the House, begging Trump the dictator to please do the right thing. That's what we get from the Democratic leadership when it comes to the most impeachable offense. This is like the most impeachable thing he's done so far. And just to shift gears a little bit from Iran in the Middle East to Israel, the latest news coming out of Gaza is that the IDF is firing on
Palestinians were waiting in lines at food trucks trying to get food. 56,000 people killed already in this thing. And these survivors trying to eke out a living in the rubble, which I'll remind my friends at the high school reunion that Gaza is the size of the Boise Meridian Nampa Metroplex. From US 20 in the north to I-84 in the south, from the Boise foothills in the east over to Caldwell in the west. That's about the size of Gaza. Now imagine that all flattened, every building leveled, rubble everywhere, but about five times as many people. That's our ally. That's the country we're supporting. We are complicit in a genocide. And Democrats so afraid of getting a primary attack from AIPAC and these associated political committees that refuse to hold Israel to account, that continue to turn a blind eye to this genocide. And it's no wonder Democrats continue to lose support, because somebody, one of the two parties, ought to be anti-genocide. I just think maybe that's something we ought to have in our politics. And following up on one other national story, that the Minnesota assassination attempts and successes from that guy who was going around dressing like a cop. He looked like a cop, had cop uniform, had a cop-looking SUV, which is how he was able to gain access in the first home to commit the assassination. Looked like a cop. So when this was happening, Minnesota public officials were telling people, don't trust any single cop, right? We're going to send the police. If we send the police to your door, we're going to send them in a pair, so you know everything's okay. So, okay, the message we're getting here is you can't trust a guy who's dressed up as a cop. And so if I see that guy who's dressed up like a fake cop, I should call the authorities. If you see something, say something. Call the authorities. Meanwhile, the streets of California, you got these vigilante bounty hunters. I refuse to call them ICE agents because I don't see any identification that shows that they are police or federal agents of any sort. I see a bunch of Goombas in their ball caps and tack vests and jeans and neck gaiters up around their noses and mirrored shades so you can't identify them, snatching people off the street. So if I see the fake cop dressed like a cop, I should call the cops. But if I see some masked up goons grabbing people off the street, don't call the cops, because they could be iced. I could be charged with, you know, impeding an officer or something. Kind of glad I'm doing a podcast late this week, because this morning I get to revel in the win by Zoran Mamdani, the 33-year-old Democratic Socialist who apparently has won the New York City Democratic primary for mayor and defeating the former governor of the state, Andrew Cuomo, who doesn't live in New York City, who hates New York City, who during his time as governor used to raid the MTA, which is their transit authority funds, from New York City. He's generally an anti-New York City guy, but he was running for mayor of New York City because nothing matters anymore. And it's so, so great that Zoran Mamdani has won this. And not just because I'm a big supporter of democratic socialism, and the fact that he's 33 years old, to see the Democrats actually getting behind someone young is amazing. But for me, it's the fall of Andrew Cuomo and this repudiation of establishment centrism from the Democratic Party that rushed to get in line to endorse a guy that they had all been calling to step down just 4 years prior. If you don't remember, Andrew Cuomo was involved in a few things. There's a few scandals. Most people are pointing to the fact that he resigned over his sexual harassment scandals, like because some 11 or 13 women, something like that, stepped up to say what a sex pest he was, a real creep, hitting on women and making them feel uncomfortable and so forth. And with Me Too and so forth, all of that, we got more heightened awareness of this, and he was pressured to resign and did so. He resigned in disgrace. But that wasn't the only thing he had to resign over. His reign as governor of New York was characterized by this strong-armed, Trumpian revenge type of politics that has become so ingrained in the New York Democratic machine. So one of the scandals was nursing home deaths. During the COVID era, a whole bunch of people died in nursing homes, and he did all sorts of stuff to try to cover that up. So it's not just the sexual harassment stuff, but that was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back. So he comes back around this time and decides he's going to run for mayor of New York City. Eric Adams is also running. He's the current mayor, also kind of in disgrace at this moment. He's rerunning as an independent, and Cuomo may do the same, rerun as an independent. But this was a ranked choice voting election. And if you don't know what that is, this is something that we ought to be fighting for all across the United States. They started in Maine. It's in a few other places. Portland, Oregon uses it for their elections. Ranked choice voting just basically means you get to rank everybody that's running. You get to vote for more than one person. You can say, well, if I don't like person A, then person B is my second choice and person C is my third choice. And the way that the voting works is we tally up all the first place votes. And then if nobody gets over 50% of all the first choices, whoever is the last place person, we take them out of the running and we find out who the people that voted for the loser, who was their second choice. And all those second choice votes get added to the first choice votes. Well, eventually you come up with someone who's going to rank more than 50%. So Andrew Cuomo, the campaign about this has all been about ranking Zohran Mamdani and other candidates, including Brad Lander, the comptroller, who was finishing third in this election, were cross-endorsing. Now, Brad Lander's a little more moderate a guy than Zohran Mamdani, who's a Democratic Socialist. But Mamdani said, look, rank me number one and then rank Brad Lander number two. And Brad Lander said, hey, rank me number one, but then rank Zohran Mamdani number two. And everybody was saying, yeah, rank me, but then rank the other guy, but don't rank Cuomo. Because that's the other thing you can do in ranked choice voting is not give a rank to somebody. You can say A is my first choice, B is my second choice, C is my third choice, and D can fuck off. you just don't give them any points whatsoever. And that appears to be what has happened in this race. Zohran came out with like 44-45% of the first place votes, and Cuomo got like 36% of the first place votes. Lander got like 10 or 11%, and then the rest of them are in the single digits. But everybody was so aware that nobody was that like if you were a Cuomo person, you put him as your first choice, but very few people were putting Cuomo as a second choice or a third choice or anything like that. So early in the evening, once Mamdani had gotten to about a 7-point lead, Cuomo went and called him to concede because he recognized the math just wasn't there in any of the second place, third place, fourth place, fifth place votes to get any more votes for himself. So he's conceded the primary. Zohran Mamdani will be the Democratic nominee for mayor of New York City. And in such a blue city like that, the Democratic nominee is usually the person that ends up winning the mayoralty. Could be different this year with Adams running as an independent, and we have yet to see whether Cuomo's going to follow through and run as an independent himself. But this is earth-shaking news to the Democratic establishment, because the Democratic Socialist types, the lefty types, Bernie Sanders, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, they all came out for Zohran and came out strongly for Zohran. And the hits on Zwan are like, okay, so he's young, doesn't have a lot of experience, although he's been in elected office for 4 years. So it's not like he's a total newbie. But it got really ugly as well. The Cuomo campaign had tens of millions of dollars of super PAC money to throw at this. People in New York are saying the ads were just saturated all over the TV. Anti-Mamdani ads, all with this tinge of racism and Islamophobia. But will he condemn the phrase globalize the intifada? A phrase he doesn't even say, right? Trying to paint him as anti-Jewish. Brad Lander, who cross-endorsed him, is Jewish. And said, hey, you're not going to divide us Muslims and Jews like that. The tricks didn't work. And it goes back to this thing that I've been saying about Democrats for a long time, right? It's like always criticizing what the other side does, but when it comes time for you, you do the same damn thing. We got to criticize the Republicans for the Willie Horton ad in the George W. Bush years and for the ways that they would, you know, change photographs to darken the skin of minority candidates to make them look even more ethnic. And well, they did the same damn thing. The Democratic super PACs did the same damn thing to Zoran Mamdani. They put out photographs, they darkened his skin, all these little racist dog whistles and Islamophobic dog whistles. That's the type of politics younger Democrats are starting to reject. And that's what this election shows, is that they're rejecting that establishment Democratic centrism. Because another aspect of this election that was wonderful to enjoy were the people lining up to support Cuomo. You had Jim Clyburn from South Carolina, because you know in South Carolina, the New York City mayor's race is an important thing to watch. Jim Clyburn, 84 years old out of South Carolina, number three Democrat. I think he's still the number three Democrat in the House. You know, Jim Clyburn, the one who, when Bernie Sanders was surging, when Bernie Sanders won the Iowa primary and or caucus and the New Hampshire primary in 2020, and all the centrists freak out, the Pete Buttigieg and the Kirsten Gillibrands and the Kamala Harris's, and to somewhat extent the Elizabeth Warren, although she's not typically a centrist. But remember that when everybody else in the primary decided, oh, geez, we all have to withdraw and get behind Joe Biden, who was placing, what, fifth at the time, sixth, something like that. That was Jim Clyburn organizing that. That was Jim Clyburn circling the wagons of the establishment to make sure to put down any threat from the left. Any chance that the Democratic Party might move leftward, we got to nip that shit in the bud. So that Jim Clyburn, he came out strong. He was one of the big heavyweights to come out there first and foremost. Full-throated endorsement of Andrew Cuomo. And I love the endorsements because they always had to get around the fact that he resigned in disgrace just 4 years ago. Well, he might have some issues here and there, but he's got the experience. He's got the experience we need to fight against Trump. Yeah. Following him, we had James Carville, 80-year-old James Carville, who still has a career because he got lucky in 92 and 96 because Ross Perot sucked away votes from the Republicans. Yeah. Yeah. James Carville held up as some sort of Democratic mastermind genius for getting Bill Clinton across the finish line with two plurality wins. Woohoo! Yeah, my phone thinks so too. So James Carville, age 80. And Bill Clinton himself, age 78. Well, you know, sex pests have to stick together, I suppose. I wonder who Harvey Weinstein was endorsing. Did somebody ask Bill Cosby who he thought should win the mayor's race? So you got these ancient Democrats coming out with their endorsements, which, in my mind, only furthered to help Zoran Mamdani amongst young folks. To see all the oldsters coming out, it's like, wait a minute, weren't all you guys condemning this guy 4 years ago for being a sex pest? And speaking of condemning sex pests, how about New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, who got behind Andrew Cuomo, who just 4 years ago was saying, me too, when it comes to the Andrew Cuomo allegations. But this time around, oh, well, you know, we've got to get behind the guy with the experience. I mean, Al Franken had a lot of experience, and he had to resign after your pressuring Kirsten Gillibrand for a fake boob grab photo. He didn't actually grab a girl's boobs. He was faking it before he was a senator, back when he was still a comedian, while he was on a USO comedy tour. Had to resign from the Senate. But there's Kirsten Gillibrand forgoing all her Me Too principles and jumping right behind Andrew Cuomo for him to get elected. Well, I sure hope people hold Bill Clinton and James Carville, Jim Clyburn, and Kirsten Gillibrand, and every one of these Democrats that lined up behind Andrew Cuomo. Well, I sure hope now that in the spirit of party unity, that they can put those differences aside and now strongly endorse Zoran Mamdani. Other national news that I missed this week. So much happened this week. That's like, I'm thinking, wow, was that really this last week? And yes, it was. We had our senator from California, Alex Padilla, trying to ask a question of Kristi Noem, getting manhandled by her goons. And the thing that bothered me about this, two things. One was J.D. Vance coming out shortly thereafter and calling him Jose Padilla, as if J.D. Vance doesn't know that the senator from California is named Alex. And as if he doesn't know that there was, back in the George W. Bush 2000 era, a well-known terrorist named Jose Padilla, who later changed his name to some Muslim name. I'm sure it was just a simple Freudian slip, right? But then Senator Padilla himself had something to say that bothered me. And I've heard other people saying something along these same lines, other officials saying this. If they can do this to a sitting United States senator, they could do this to anyone. Senator, that's not the kind of flex you think it is. It seems kind of out of touch, because guess what? We know that. It's been done to us. We've been roughed up by the cops. We've been having our arms twisted behind our backs while they say don't resist. We know it can happen to us. What we're expecting our senators is to do something about it. Like impeach this motherfucker. And we've got these cops. We got these ICE agents, and folks, they're not agents. They're not ICE agents. You know what's happening here. They've got bounty hunters. They've got militia cosplayers. The reason they're all wearing the masks and not identifying themselves is because, in my view, these are people that don't have any legal authority to be making detentions or to make any sort of arrests. And we cannot have a society where there are masked cops, masked agents, masked goons, just grabbing people, just pointing automatic weapons in public and grabbing people and throwing them into unmarked cars. Video came out earlier I saw as well, where the ICE guys, again, goons, we don't know that they're agents, that these goons are in parking lots switching their license plates off, changing license plates. So there's been a meme going around on the internet, which I actually think is a good idea. Why don't we start dressing up like them? Why don't we start putting together groups of volunteers who dress in the ball caps and the shades and the face masks and the tack vests and all that stuff? And let's have them escorting immigrants to their court cases in various places. And then the goons that show up, they won't know if we're them and they're us and who's hauling who. We'll just say, oh no, we got this one. We got them all wrapped up. We're the other team. We already picked them up. Yeah. I mean, cause what? Are they going to charge us with impersonating an officer for doing exactly what they're doing? They're not wearing stuff that says they're officers. They're not showing real official badges. Let's do the same thing. I even have an idea. Let's call it Militia Enabling Legal Transport. Melt. You got the ice. We got the melt. Focus more of my attention on the Democratic Party, and in particular, their failure to understand the moment in which we live. We are under attack by a fascist coup, undergirded by Russian psyops and corporate brainwashing. We are under attack. Our democratic way of life is under attack. They are literally killing Democrats. The stochastic terrorism has ratcheted up. The right-wing threat is so great that Democratic officials now are having to get extra security and worry for their lives. And we don't hear enough Republicans condemning this either. But I want to stick to the Democrats here, because the Democrats continue to operate as if there's going to be elections, and as if there's going to continue to be a Congress to have to work with. There could be elections, and there could be future Congresses to have to work with if we fight for them. Understand, that is not the other side's goal. The other side is not interested in democracy. They don't act like it, do they? Do you see the Republicans acting like they are afraid of another election? We just had Mitch McConnell coming out saying that with respect to the fact that there's going to be all these Medicaid cuts, all these people are going to be losing their health care, and it's making some of the Republicans nervous that, oh my gosh, if we vote for this stuff, maybe our constituents won't like it. And Mitch McConnell saying they'll get over it. Losing their health care, they'll get over it. This comes on the heel of Joni Ernst when asked about, you know, the Medicare cuts and Medicaid cuts going to kill people. She says, well, we all die. We're all going to die. That's the midterm message from the Republican Party. We're all going to die, so just get over it. And yet the Democrats still find themselves losing to these people. And it's because they continue since 1992 to paint themselves as Republican light. Oh, yes, we hate the immigrants and the situation at the border, too, and we'll put together a really tough conservative bill along with a conservative senator, and oh, see how conservative we are in immigration? What has that gotten you? We need to be the party that stands up against genocide. Oh, except when our allies are doing it. We need to be the party that stands up against corruption. You know, unless Nancy Pelosi can make some money trading stocks. We need to be the party that believes in women's right to choose. It's a fundamental human right to be in control of one's own reproductive system. But it's okay that Henry Cuellar doesn't think that. We need that Democrat in Texas. Otherwise, we wouldn't have that seat. We can make an allowance for one of our people to think women ought to be breeding slaves. We need to end gerrymandering. We need a party that's against gerrymandering. Gerrymandering is anti-democratic. It dilutes the will of the people. But over here in New York, we'll go ahead and gerrymander because we're Democrats and we're in charge here. It's when the Republicans do it in the red states that it's bad. Yeah, and we need to be against this terrible racism, Islamophobia. You know, unless a democratic socialist is going to win in New York State and then, you know, pull out all the stops and get all the Islamophobia we can possibly get there. Let's do that. So you can see why the Democratic Party has an approval rating in the cellar. 27% last I looked. Even underwater among Democrats, it's like a 40 to 49, like 40% approve, 49% disapprove. 9 points underwater with your own party. Well, there's more examples of that. Why people are turning off to the Democratic Party. It comes after this Iran bombing, which, again, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez came right out and said, this is illegal. This is the most unconstitutional thing ever, and he should be impeached for it. So someone went and drew up the impeachment. Representative Al Green, who's drawn up a couple of impeachment articles lately, because it's the right thing to do. But the Democratic leadership has this attitude, oh, we can't be bringing up impeachment because, you know, we're not in charge here. And if we file a bill for impeachment, well, the Speaker of the House is a Republican and he won't let it go anywhere. And, you know, since it will fail anyway, there's no point in us fighting. This lay down and die attitude. When on the other side, they do nothing but fight Democrats 24/7. Everything is a Democrat's fault. Every Democrat is bad. They're all terrible. Nothing should be bipartisan. The party should be wiped out. Republicans should be in charge forever and ever. Amen. As Jesus intended. Start to understand that's the way your opponents think. And start to fight. Because the fight, the value in the fight isn't always winning the fight. The value of the fight is fighting. Is showing your constituents you believe in something and will fight for it against all odds. Like Zohan Mamdani did. He started his campaign, he was at like 1% in the polls. Nobody knew who the hell he was. But he went out and talked to people and was honest and forthcoming about his goals and his policies to help the bottom 50% of the people have a better life. That's what we want to see. We want to see some fight. We want to see some belief in something. So Al Green draws up his impeachment resolution for Trump over his illegal bombing of Iran. 128 Democrats in the House voted no. Voted to table it, I should say. Basically to, you know, let's put this on the back burner. It's not going to go anywhere. Kind of a vote. 128 voted to table it. Didn't even bother to let the Republicans own tabling the impeachment. You basically gave a bipartisan cover to any Fox News talking head who wants to say, even the Democrats don't think that if Trump should be impeached over bombing Iran. They must not be serious about this War Powers Act stuff. See, even the Democrats don't care that Trump bombed Iran. It must be okay for presidents to go ahead and just drop bombs on people. That's what that is sent. That's the message that's sent by that. That over half the party doesn't even care enough to impeach him over it. 128 Democrats, of course, Jeffries was one of them, leader of the House Democrats, voting no, voting to table an impeachment resolution. Because, gosh, we just can't win. We wouldn't want to make the Republicans upset. I'm also calling out three Oregon Democrats who voted to table the impeachment resolution. As usual, the odious Janelle Bynum, but also Hoyle and Salinas. Three of the five Oregon Democrats in the House voted to table that resolution. Well, there is one little bright spot for the Democrats this week. I did notice that a new ranking member for the House Oversight Committee has been elected. This was the seat that was held by Jerry Connolly, who was put in that seat rather than Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. You know, because we needed a plus 70-year-old who's battling cancer, who's not a household name and not a very good communicator, to be in the most important House committee to draw attention to the evil of the Trump maladministration. You wouldn't want to have some young, attractive, charismatic, extremely popular person in that position. And of course, Jerry Connolly went and died the day before the vote on the big, ugly bullshit bill that he could have voted against. Anyway, that position's been filled now, but not by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Instead, it's Robert Garcia has been appointed to this House oversight. Now, I don't know exactly where Garcia stands. I don't think he's any sort of Dem socialist like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is. But he does have one bright thing going for him in this Democratic Party. He's only 47 years old. Oh, my
God that Democrats appointed someone to a leadership position under the age of 70.
Let me turn my attention to the other side of the aisle and show you what the Republicans have been up to these days. The ICE thing continues, this whole deportation, extrajudicial rendition, shipping people off to concentration camps and torture facilities. It continues apace. And I make note of one incident that took place in Louisiana. And this is reported out of Tennessee, basically. But basically, the story is a woman was 5 months pregnant, and she's having a baby boy with her American citizen fiance. So she's married to an American. She's 5 months pregnant. She lost her baby while she was in ICE custody at a detention center. She was repeatedly calling for prenatal care. She lived and worked in Tennessee for years. She was detained by ICE for over a month, had to sleep on the prison cell floor, getting served food with cockroaches in it. Said she's starving and having stomach pains. This is a 5 months pregnant woman, so she's showing. The guard said, oh, that's normal. She begged to be deported. Please deport me to Guatemala so at least once I get to Guatemala, I could get some prenatal care. They wouldn't. So she ends up delivering a stillborn baby in front of two guards who had her feet shackled. Then for the next 2 days after bearing her dead child, she wasn't allowed to call her fiancé. She wasn't allowed to talk to anyone. Had to just sit on the floor of her cold cell, crying all alone. So there's your party of life, right? There's your pro-life party. Grabbing the brown pregnant woman, throwing in a cell, giving her no prenatal care until she has a stillbirth. Now, flip to the other side of this situation, and you have the woman in Georgia, the black woman in Georgia, who was brain dead, who the state forced to keep alive on feeding tubes and ventilators, even though she's brain dead, even though her family wanted to let her go. They kept her alive because she was pregnant. And they just this week delivered that baby by cesarean section against the wishes of the parents who were forced to pay for all of this as well. They have to pay all these medical bills because of the culture of pro-life, because Georgia has one of those anti-abortion laws. And since this doesn't threaten the health of the mother, that's the exception, right? If it threatens the health of the mother. Well, she's brain dead. Wasn't threatening her health at all. The rest of her body was perfectly fine. So the state and many conservative commentators, many Republicans reasoned, well, why not? Let's keep that baby alive, use that woman's body as an incubator against her wishes, against her family's wishes. Use it as a baby incubator. So this is a party that can simultaneously tell you the Guatemalan woman who was pregnant and alive should lose her baby to stillbirth because she didn't get any medical attention. Meanwhile, the black woman who's dead will give her all the medical attention her family doesn't want to force her to bear a child against her wishes. And understand the logic behind this kind of thing. What they're saying is we can use a woman's body against her will to save the life of another.
In this case, the fetal child. Well, if that's the logic, then what's to stop this from... there's a guy in the ER. He was hit by a car and he's brain dead. Everybody run in and grab all the organs. Let's get his heart and his liver and his spleen and his eyes and all the other organs, because there's other people whose lives depend on them. They would die without them. What? He didn't sign an organ donor card. Well, who cares? Those other people's lives depend on him, just like that woman and her little unborn child. So you realize that, right? Like, if someone could live from getting my kidney and I were brain dead on an operating table, you could not take my kidney. You could not use my kidney if I did not sign that organ donor card. You can't use parts of my body without my permission, even if I'm dead, if I did not give that permission when I was alive. But a uterus? There's an exception for a uterus, apparently. We can use someone's uterus if it'll help someone else live. Absolutely disgusting. Other things Republicans have been into? Well, we've got the latest ruling from SCROTUS. That's what I call them, SCROTUS, the Supreme Court Republicans of the United States, SCROTUS. In a 6-3 decision, as all the SCROTUS decisions are, they ruled that Tennessee and Idaho and all the other states that have these things now can legally ban gender-affirming health care for trans kids. They can legally ban it, even if the kid wants the gender-affirming care, even if parents want the gender-affirming care, even if the doctor recommends the gender-affirming care, even if every medical institution and organization recommends the gender-affirming care, a bunch of lawmakers can say no. Your state government can say no, even though you want that care. And people freak out about this, thinking, oh my God, they're doing genital surgeries and such. Never mind the fact that we circumcise almost every young infant boy, right? Without their permission, they're little babies, they don't know. That seems to be okay. We can do that. But a grown-up kid who might want to have pop surgery with his parents, with her parents' permission, the doctor's permission, that's no good. We can't have that. But if that same girl who wanted, you know, that girl can't transition to be a boy and have top surgery, but if that girl wanted to have breast implants to be more girly, that's okay. That's not banned. She wants to have a nose job to make her face look more feminine. That's fine. I don't understand this. And the way the SCROTUS got around this had to do with what level of scrutiny has to be applied to the law. And the way it works out is, like, is this sex discrimination to ban gender-affirming care for minors? And the reasoning of the court basically worked out to saying, no, it's not, because we're banning gender-affirming care for both boys and girls. We're not discriminating on the basis of sex, because both sexes are discriminated against equally, which is the exact sort of logic that the Supreme Court invalidated in the decision of Loving v. Virginia. That was the same kind of logic that the racists tried to use to ban interracial marriage. They said, oh no, this isn't racist. Banning interracial marriage isn't racist, because we say white people can't marry interracially, and black people can't marry interracially, and Asian people can't marry interracially, and Mexican people can't, and so on, right? Since it discriminates against everybody equally, it's not discriminatory. That's the road they're taking us down, folks. And it's only a short hop from there to say, oh, well, banning gay marriage, that's not sexist or discriminatory in any way, because we're saying gay men can't get married and gay women can't get married. See, it's equal. Disgusting SCROTUS decision. And there's another, before I leave that one though, let me mention, when this decision came out on the trans kids, there was Chuck Schumer with a statement saying, this is a distraction from the president ripping away health care because, my God, the centrist Democrats want to make this a policy battle over Medicaid. They want to make this about Medicaid numbers, which I'm not dismissing that that's an issue. Absolutely. We should point out that the Republicans want your grandma to die. But it's not a distraction, Chuck. This is the number one thing for some poor kid. Imagine being a trans kid at age 6 back in 2000 when Biden was getting into office. You're 6 years old. You're starting to recognize that you're trans. But now here's a president who's got trans officers in the cabinet. Here's who celebrates pride, who's strong on trans rights, or at least as strong as a Democrat can be. Imagine the hope you'd have been filled with for the past 4 years, 2020 to 2024. Then you're getting to be about 10, 11. Here comes puberty just over the horizon. And Trump gets into office. And all these anti-trans bans go into effect. And the Supreme Court says that you have to go through that male puberty. How cruel, just how cruel to these kids. And to call that a distraction, Chuck Schumer. Look, there are no distractions. This is not the Republicans playing 3D chess saying, I know, if we get them talking about the trans kids, they'll forget we're taking away Medicare. No. They're fascists, Chuck. They are fighting a fascist war on many fronts. There are no distractions. There are only fronts. There's the immigration front. There's the transgender front. There's the violence front. There's lots of fronts. There's no distractions. Now, let me get to the other SCROTUS decision. This one had to do with the third country deportations. Okay, so here's the deal. Case comes before the court as to whether or not the Trump administration can send people, deport people, to a country that they've never lived before, that they have no ties to. And in particular, a place where they could be in grave danger, tortured or killed. So we have this law, we have a federal law against torture. I can't remember the exact name of it, but the way it works is you got an immigrant and the government wants to deport him. So they get their day in court and the government informs the immigrant as to the possible places they may be deported to. Let's say country A, B, C, D, and E. Here's the five places we might deport you to, A, B, C, D, or E. Then the immigrant has the chance to rebuke some of those, or all of them, based on the fact that they might be subject to torture there. The immigrant in court can say, oh, no, A, B, C, D, E. Look, you can't send me to A or B or C. They'll kill me there. They'll torture me there. So the law says that when the immigrant and can prove in court that there's a legitimate fear of being tortured or killed on return to those countries, the government cannot deport them to those countries. So the government comes in court, says, we're going to send you to possibly A, B, C, D, or E. And then the immigrant says, don't send me to A, B, or C. I could be tortured there. Well, you'd think then the next step is the government then deports you to D or E, right? Well, the Trump administration came around and said, well, we're going to deport you to F. F? Nobody brought up F in court. I never got a chance to say whether or not I'd get tortured at F. And Trump came back to the Supreme Court and said, hey, the law only says where we can't deport them to. Doesn't say where we can deport them to. And doesn't say in the initial court case that we had to list all the possible places we could deport them to. And the Supreme Court agreed with them. The Supreme Court said, yeah, sure, go ahead. Well, there's kind of a catch to it. The Supreme Court basically said, oh, that's kind of a loophole. And we don't know whether the law does say that you have to say all the places or that you can pick a place you didn't say, but it doesn't say you can't do that. So we don't know yet. So you can go ahead and do that for now until another case comes up for us to decide whether or not you can do that. Yeah, that's the workaround. A law that the clear intent of this law is don't send people where they'll get tortured. They're allowing a loophole that says, well, you didn't say, it doesn't say a dog can't dunk a basketball. This Supreme Court, the SCROTUS, will find any loophole they can to help enable the fascism. It's about damn time the Democrats recognize that. In regional news, I want to talk about this case coming out of Gastonia, North Carolina. It's a case of Samuel Jenkins and Jessica Ivy. The couple, by the way, Samuel is black and Jessica is white, just in case this makes any difference to how you interpret this story. Jenkins and his wife, Jessica Ivy, were arrested because their son, their 7-year-old son, Legend, was struck and killed when he stepped into a road. Kid was hit by a car and died. And they were arrested 2 days after that and charged with involuntary manslaughter and multiple counts of child abuse. The reason being, they allowed their 10 and 7-year-old to walk home 2 blocks away without an adult. They let the kid walk home for 2 blocks, got hit by a car, so they are charged with involuntary manslaughter and multiple counts of child abuse. And I just have to say, if letting your kid walk home alone without an adult present is some form of child abuse, we need to retroactively charge every parent of every Gen X person in the United States of America. Oh my God, this is ridiculous. I mean, first of all, when there is a case of someone's kid dying like this, that parent is already suffering the greatest punishment they could ever imagine. The loss of their child. Oh my God, how the pain that must be felt there. And unless they did something incredibly negligent to lead to that kid's death, the kid's death alone should be the punishment. They've got enough grieving to do. But this prosecutor decides to hold them on these child abuse and involuntary manslaughter charges, posted on them a $1.5 million bond. So there's no possible way they could get out. Now, later, that was reduced to a $150,000 bond. Ooh. Which still, for most people, that means you got to come up with 10% for a bailed bondsman. That's $15,000 for each of them. So that's $30,000. They don't got that kind of money. So they're still sitting in jail, crying in a cell over their child's death. What had happened is the mom had taken the kids, the two kids, 10 and 7, to the store. And the kids wanted to go home early because they're bored at the store. And they only live 2 blocks away. And so she said, go ahead, go home. The kids didn't walk down to the crosswalk, though. They kind of crossed in the middle of the street. And crossing in the middle of the street, wasn't seen an elderly woman hit the boy. She's not charged. She has no wrongdoing. She didn't do anything wrong. But the kid got hit and later died in the hospital. And with these charges, this is going to be so traumatic because they've got 5 other kids. And so they're going to lose custody of the kids. They're going to have to find someone else to take care of the kids. They still got to come up with the funeral expenses for their own kid. It's just a terrible case. So I don't have much more to say about it than that, other than, like I said, if that's child abuse, then every kid I grew up with was an abused child.
Well, that country baseline can mean only one thing. It's time for our Boycott Idaho segment, the segment where I explain to you all the reasons why you should avoid the handmade state. Now up to 70 reasons. You can find them at radicalrust.com/Idaho. Do what you can to boycott Idaho. Don't go skiing in Sun Valley. There's much better mountains in Utah. Don't go whitewater rafting in Idaho. There's great rivers in Oregon. And when it comes to your side dish, avoid the potato. Boycott the Idaho potato. There's no state that is more singularly associated with one agricultural product than Idaho and the potato. Maybe Iowa and corn, but definitely Idaho and the potato. Rented lips, my fault. You know what I'm saying, boycott Idaho, even though I'm going back there for my 40th class reunion this weekend. But I tell you what, I pledge to spend no money in Idaho while I'm there. Watch me. Anyway, in our Boycott Idaho segment today, I want to talk about the new law that goes into effect on July 1st in the state of Idaho, Idaho's anti-camping law. Idaho's anti-camping law, which doesn't apply to all of Idaho. It only applies to cities that are over 100,000 in population, and that would be Boise, Meridian, and my hometown of Nampa, home of the Nampa High School Bulldogs. Yeah, so the Boise, Meridian, Nampa metro area, which I always like to remind people is about the same size as Gaza, anywhere within those city limits, it will now be a crime to sleep in cars or otherwise on public sidewalks, parks, or public property, regardless of the availability of emergency shelter beds. Now, that last part, regardless of the availability of emergency shelter beds, owes to my hometown here in Oregon, Grants Pass, which is the subject of the Grants Pass Supreme Court case that decided that no, it's not a violation of the Eighth Amendment's prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment to throw people in a jail cell for sleeping outside just because they have nowhere else to go. That's not a crime. That's not against the Constitution. There doesn't have to be a shelter. You can just lock people up for existing outside. So Boise, of course, Idaho, of course, is taking advantage of that decision and saying this new anti-camping law, you cannot sleep in your car or on sidewalks or outside anywhere in the city limits of Boise, Meridian, or Nampa. Cities that fail to enforce the law are subject to fines. So, yeah, your city's going to lose out on money unless you force your cops to arrest homeless people. Anti-camping bill. So, can't even sleep in your car for this bill. Now, of course, there are all sorts of unintended consequences of this kind of stuff. You make it illegal to sleep in your car in the city limits of Boise, Meridian, or Nampa. Well, then you just sleep in your car in Eagle, or in Star, or in Cuna, or in Caldwell, or Homedale, or Nissa, or Parma. There's a lot of little towns in that Boise, Meridian, Nampa metro area that are not a part of the Boise, Meridian, and Nampa city limits. So get ready for that. Another bit of news coming out of the state of Idaho, just a brief note of this. A couple of teenagers, Alan Fisher and Rochelle Fisher, were disappeared from their Montague, Idaho home. They are part of the FLDS cult. I don't know about this. It's the, what's the F stand for? Foundational Latter-day Saints Church. I don't remember. Whatever. But it's that Warren Jeffs cult. You remember this guy? Warren Jeffs, the polygamist, had like 80 some odd wives, leading his little sex cult. He's been busted on. He's in prison right now for sexual abuse charges against children, but he's still leading the cult from his jail cell. And so the theory behind this case is that these two kids were abducted by an older sibling who went missing on January 23rd because this FLDS church now, this Warren Jeffs now, has a new prophecy, you see. God has given him a new prophecy having to do with rounding up all the devout to become what are called translated beings. Through death and resurrection, they will become translated beings. So maybe setting up some sort of
Jim Jones mass suicide thing? I don't know, but that's what the concern here is over the disappearance of these two kids. But it once again points out how religion poisons everything. And why I am such a secular person. Like, I'm all for your belief in whatever you want to believe. But remember, what you believe sometimes adds some credence to what others believe. The people who believe that there's this omnipotent, omniscient God out there who intervenes in human life can be a benign thing when you're thinking of, you know, oh, it's God's plan this or it's God's will that. But it can become quite malignant when one of those guys says, oh, yeah, that omnipotent God that you're talking about all the time, I talked to him too. And he says I had to round up all these 16 to 21 year old kids and have them killed. Because, you know, he's omniscient, so and he talks directly to me, and so how is that any different than how he talks to you? Right? There's just some, you lend a little credence to the crazies by believing in the same kind of crazy. Today in the Radical Rant, I want to talk about something absolutely frivolous: TV theme songs. As you may know, I participate every Saturday morning in a little hashtag group on Blue Sky called hashtag AT40. And it's those of us who are listening live to the Sirius XM 70s on 7 channel when they replay the Casey Kasem American Top 40 show. And it's a replay of the countdown from this week in one of the years of the 1970s. So this week it'd be 76, next week it'd be 79, whatever, but it's always this week in one of the years in the 70s. And so we use hashtag AT40 to talk about the songs and all of the artists and make jokes and so forth. Well, this last week that they had the AT40 on, it was 1976. And being that it's June, it was the summer of 76. And one of the things about the summer of 1976 is it was the year of the TV theme song. It's quite amazing, right? So in 1976, there was a period where there were 4 TV theme songs on the top 40 charts. Oh, and I should make a mention here to the younger listeners. TV shows used to have theme songs. Like, there was a whole song, not like just a quick little couple of notes and stuff, but like there was a whole song that you would listen to. And sometimes these songs got released as singles and they were so popular they'd make the charts. Yeah, I know, crazy. So yeah, 1976, from actually it was from November 15th, 1975 to July 24th, 1976, there was at least one TV theme song on the Billboard Hot 100. And in May to June of 76, there were 4 themes in the Hot 100, with June 12th being the all-time best week for TV theme songs. Those TV theme songs were the theme from SWAT, that was in 75, and the 4 from 76, Welcome Back Cotter, which was Welcome Back, the Happy Days theme, These Days Are Ours, Beretta, Keep Your Eye on the Sparrow, by Rhythm Heritage, Pratt and McLean did the Happy Days one, and then Making Our Dreams Come True, the Cindy Greco song from Laverne and Shirley. So Welcome Back Cotter, Beretta, Happy Days, and Laverne and Shirley were all on the charts in June of 1976. So little TV theme trivia. Let me give you some more TV theme trivia, because I actually was able to calculate there were 42 theme songs that made it to the top 40 charts. And I should also iterate here, when I'm talking about TV theme songs that made the charts, I'm talking about the songs that were the TV show theme first, then they made the charts later. So we're not counting things like Billy Joel's My Life that was on Bosom Buddies, or The Who's Won't Get Fooled Again that's on CSI, because those were chart hits first that then became TV theme songs. Not talking about that. TV theme songs that became chart hits. So, some trivia. First charting TV theme song was Zorro by the Cordettes that hit the charts in 1958, made it to number 17. The last TV theme song to make the charts was I'll Be There For You, the theme song to the TV show Friends that made the charts in 1995. So we have a span from 1958 to 1995 where 42 songs made the charts. Some other trivia about this. The all-time greatest TV show theme, at least counting by the most weeks at the top, was How Do You Talk to an Angel by The Heights. There was a show called The Heights, and in 92, this thing went to number one. It stayed at number one for 2 weeks, and it spent 10 weeks in the top 10. Second closest song was the theme from Soul Train, The Sound of Philadelphia, TSOP, by MFSB in 1974, also made it to number one and spent 2 weeks at number one. There are three other TV theme songs that made it to number one: the Welcome Back Cotter theme by John Sebastian, the Miami Vice theme by Jan Hammer, and the theme from SWAT by Rhythm Heritage, all made number one. Those last three only spent 1 week at number one. The song that spent the most weeks in the Billboard Hot 100 was Believe It or Not, the theme song to The Greatest American Hero. Remember that sitcom? The guy, he finds the Superman suit, but he doesn't have the instruction manual to know how it runs. It was a funny show. Anyway, Believe It or Not spent half the damn year of 1981 in the Hot 100. It actually spent 37 weeks in the Hot, or I'm sorry, 26 weeks in the Hot 100. Whole half year that The Greatest American Hero was on the charts, Believe It or Not. And actually, if it weren't for Diana Ross and Lionel Richie holding down the top spot with Endless Love, Believe It or Not could have been the all-time greatest TV theme, because it spent like, what, 2 weeks at number two, and it couldn't get to number one because of Endless Love. There was also two hit makers who hit with three different TV themes. Henry Mancini had a hit with the Charlie's Angels theme, the Peter Gunn theme, and the Mr. Lucky theme. And Mike Post, the king of the TV themes in the 80s, hit with three different TV themes: Hill Street Blues, Magnum P.I., and the Rockford Files. There you go. Look at TV theme songs. And if you'd like more information on this, you can visit my blog at radicalrust.com. Just do a search for TV themes or click on the rock and roll category. You should be able to find all the information. Hey, before I wrap things up, I wanted to give you an update on our hashtag free TV night. I've been posting on Blue Sky lately whenever I watch some new movie on free TV, because I know a lot of you are like me, you're having to cut back on your streaming services, so you're forced to go to the free services like Tubi or Pluto TV, and I'm trying to find some gems out there for you to watch. So check out my hashtag free TV night. Let me give you a rundown of some of the ones I watched this last week. First of all, there was a sci-fi movie, a 2021 movie called Settlers, supposedly about these colonists on Mars. And somehow we've solved, you know, the problem of the soil and not having a magnetosphere and not enough gravity for an atmosphere and all the temperature extremes. Regardless, we've solved all that in this problem. And the settlers are, I don't know, this movie just went nowhere. This is the kind of movie that at the end of it, you're like, we spent 105 minutes for that. And really, it wasn't very sci-fi. It could have been set in any kind of subtler situation. This could have been the American West. It could have been, you know, ancient China. The story didn't really have a sci-fi, much of a sci-fi angle to it. So I can't recommend 2021's Settlers. Next up, 1980's The Forbidden Zone. I saw this one flipping through, and I saw it had Hervé Villechaize in it. Older listeners will remember Hervé Villechaize as Tatou on Fantasy Island. Duplane, Duplane. So anyway, this movie Wow. I don't have enough drugs to watch this thing. I couldn't make it through about 20 minutes. It was weird. It was awful. It was high school play. It was Leonard Pinth Garnell's Bad Playhouse Theater. It was terrible. Don't spend any time on 1980s, The Forbidden Zone. But one movie I can recommend, and I'm surprised on this one, 2014's Larry Gay, Renegade Male Flight Attendant. And first of all, the cast in this thing, it's got Stanley Tucci, Taye Diggs, Henry Winkler, Molly Shannon, Rebecca Romaine, Patrick Warburton, Julie Haggerty, Marcia Gay Harden, Jason Alexander. Who else was in this? There's a bunch of, Bob Gunton, you know, the guy that played the warden in Shawshank, Jerry Burns, Rosanna Arquette, Eric Stoltz. Okay. So basically it is a kind of an airplane spoofish kind of movie. And the male flight attendant's named Larry Gay. So there's some, you know, jokes at that expense. Oh yeah. And Jemma Mays is in it too. That cute redhead girl, Jemma Mays. Oh my gosh. The only unknown person in this movie was the star, the guy who actually played the Larry Gay flight attendant. But it's funny. The one guy from Community's in it, too. I can't remember his name off the top of my head. Anyway, it had some laughs. It was cute. It's worth a watch. Larry Gay, Renegade Male Flight Attendant. Oh my God. 2022's Moonfall with Halle Berry. So I see a sci-fi movie, I see Halle Berry, I'm like, yeah, let's go. Folks, oh my God. I do not have cable thick enough to suspend the disbelief necessary to watch this movie. I watched this entire movie with the ghost of Neil deGrasse Tyson in my head. I shouldn't say ghost, he's still alive. The spirit I can just hear Neil deGrasse Tyson in my head just screaming at this movie. So the idea is the moon is actually hollow and it's an alien base and it's going to collide with the Earth. And in doing so, the scientific illiteracy in this thing is just made it unwatchable. It's just, the movie makes no sense. Skip 2022's Moonfall. I don't know if Neil deGrasse Tyson would find this one the worst one, or 1979's The Black Hole as the worst scientific movie ever, but God, it was terrible. And then to close things up here, I noticed that all the Terminator movies are online now, and I didn't realize how many damn Terminator movies there are. Like, I watched the first Terminator, obviously. That was a high school favorite. And then Terminator 2, Rise of the Machines, right? And then Terminator 3, where they had the Lady Terminator, right? I thought that was it. I thought we were out of Terminators. No, there's like three more Terminator movies and a whole Terminator TV series. So, trying to catch up on that, I caught the fifth and the sixth installments. The fifth one is called Terminator Genesis. And, it was all right. Terminator Genesis is okay. The thing that threw me off on it is it's one of them alternate timeline excuses, right? So in this alternate timeline, the Sarah Connor character that Linda Hamilton played in the 84 movie is now being played by Emilia Clarke. And so I'm watching this movie with Emilia Clarke as Sarah Connor. I'm like, oh my God, she's so young. Like, she's way too young to be playing Sarah Connor, right? So I looked it up and Emilia Clarke in the movie is 29 years old. I'm like, really? She did not look 29. And then I looked up Linda Hamilton in 84's Terminator and she was 28 at the time. So Emilia Clarke was actually older. I've just come to the realization at this point in my life at age 57, everybody under the age of 35 and over the age of 18 looks the same age to me. Like every adult 18 to 35 is just the same general age. And then the sixth one in the series is called Terminator Dark Fate. I think this one is probably my third favorite Terminator movie after 1 and 2. They did a really good job with Terminator Dark Fate. I like the, and again, it's an alternate timeline kind of thing, but this movie passes the Bechdel test with flying colors. The Bechdel test is a test in movies where if you have two women who are having a conversation about something other than a man, like so few movies feature, you know, strong, independent, well-fleshed out female characters. This movie does great. In fact, I believe we go for the first two acts almost with nothing but lead female characters running the film. So, highly recommended. Check out Terminator Dark Fate from 2019. And check out my hashtag, Free TV Night on Blue Sky. Well, folks, that's all the time we've got for this week's Smoke Session. The Radical Russ Show is produced, directed, researched, written, cited, posted, and catered by me, Radical Russ Belville, and governed by Creative Commons share-alike licensing. News clips and social media posts are reproduced under fair use copyright laws for commentary and analysis. My main theme is We Love the Herb by Herbal Nation, and interstitial music is by me and my drum machine. And now it's time for our post-credits scene. A quick note to how the Trump maladministration is again disrespecting LGBTQ people and Pride Month in general, then revealed that the National Park Service has removed the transgender flag from the Stonewall National Park Monument. That's right, the monument to the Stonewall Uprising in 1969, the noted beginning of the gay rights movement, that was started when a trans woman named Marsha Blackburn threw a brick at the police, that person's flag doesn't get to be shown at Stonewall anymore. And they've even taken out the T and the Q. They're starting to call it lesbian and gay rights. They're trying to erase transgender people. This is literally a transgender genocide these people are after. Either metaphorically in erasing transgender existence, or literally when these kids that can't get their care commit suicide. Also, of note, this week in the rock and roll community, we lost Bobby Sherman, the crooner, the 60s heartthrob, and we lost Mick Ralphs, the founder of Mott the Hoople, two musicians whose legacies will be long remembered, and condolences we give to all their friends and family and fans. And in other news, the Reverend Jimmy Swaggart, the televangelist, had a massive coronary, massive heart attack. He is still in critical condition as of this taping, and I want to send out my thoughts and prayers and best wishes to the medical team who have no ethical choice but to have to treat him. You can contact me by email at radicalrus@gmail.com. Call my message line at 877-RUSS-420. That's 877-877-420. And reach me on social media on Blue Sky as radicalrus.com. You can support this podcast financially by donating to Radical Russ on Venmo, Rad Russ on Cash App, or via PayPal on my website at radicalrus.com. Get this podcast on Spotify, Apple Music, my website, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening, and until next week, take care of each other.